It's time to take care of business. I'm Rob Rose.
And I'm Julietta Talebi.
Today, as investors make do with a scanty 11-page summary of PwC's 14-month investigation into Steinhoff's accounting irregularities, which is a quaint euphemism if ever there was one, we thought we'd speak to the two analysts who refused to buy Marcus Eustace's fables right from the beginning, Craig Butters and Andrew Cuff. Craig Butters is now with Prudential, but formerly ran a hedge fund for Brait, where he met former Steinhoff chair Christo Visser in 2009 to warn him away from what he thought could be a Ponzi scheme.
Andrew Cuff, meanwhile, was the head of research at JP Morgan, where in 2007, a young analyst called Sean Holmes compiled his own report that, as Rob has written in his book Steinheist, methodically deconstructed Steinhoff's flaky business model. Andrew, thanks very much for coming into our studios today.
Pleasure.
Andrew, you were head of research at JP Morgan, like we said, when Sean Holmes published his report, which said, I think it was 2007, which said, we are concerned about the quality of Steinhoff's earnings, especially given its poor financial disclosure and lack of transparency. It talked of a pattern of aggressive accounting. And now, in the very last couple of days, you've had this PwC summary, scant 11 pages though it is, which talked about the aggressive accounting to the tune of 106 billion rand, or 6.4 billion euros. It's nice to be right about this, isn't it?
Yes, but about 10 years too early.
Yeah, well, I suppose
timing in life is everything, right?
Exactly.
But in this case, I mean, you've read PwC's summary over the last weekend. Sure. What were your thoughts about it and what it essentially didn't contain and did contain?
Firstly, I think it does indicate the scope or the size of the fraud. It's huge. I mean, it's massive. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that it's very scant on details, and I think in some ways quite defensive. It's it doesn't give much away, and I think obviously the company, the directors are protecting themselves and they're trying to protect the company, and therefore I think they've left out a lot of details that could implicate others. For example, I think the fact that they keep emphasizing a small number of individuals involved. I just don't see how it's possible that it can be a small number of individuals involved. I think at a lower level, there were accountants who knew numbers. There were people who had to put through entries. It's not a small number.
6.4 billion euro fraud, you'd imagine that quite a few people might have known.
Sure. And entries have to be put through. I mean, ultimately, I mean, you can argue that they'd be done at a consolidated level, at a holding company level. People would put through entries. But these are entries that, by the account of this report, pertain to debtors being, you know, money being or money's owned being passed from one debtor to another debtor, and then an entry later on further on to inflate assets to get rid of the debtor and inflate an asset to obviously create the debit in the balance sheet.
I mean, you know, one talks about these complex financial transactions. Are they really complex? Or if you had a really good grounding in accounting, I mean, should these have been obvious from the get-go? Were they obvious to Sean when he published his report?
No, because they're obvious in the sense that the numbers are there, and but the explanations behind the numbers, you can believe or not believe management. You know, a lot of the numbers that Sean questioned at the time related to trademarks, things that have come to light later on. Transfer pricing was a big issue, and a lot of this is achieved through transfer pricing and things like that. So in a sense, you know, the numbers allow you to question things. It's very difficult without insider knowledge to conclude.
Yeah.
Steinhoff in its report talked about the words accounting irregularities a lot. It seemed to, perhaps because the lawyers insisted, steer away from the word fraud quite deliberately. And we spoke to Craig Butters about this a bit earlier. If we could just play back what he said to us.
I did find one interesting little bit of information, and I think it's quite significant. And the one thing that I kept asking myself was, were these just accounting irregularities, or was there misappropriation of cash and assets as well? And there is reference to that under the remedial measures paragraphs, and I think that's quite significant to me. But kept on going on about the accounting irregularities and non-compliance with laws and regulations. And clearly that is important. And in my own opinion, accounting irregularities is fraud. But immediately after that, they use the word misappropriations. And I think that's quite significant to me, as I've mentioned.
Is misappropriation not just a lawyer's word for theft?
that's how I would interpret it, yes. And it's a wide term, but I think we can assume from that, and this is my assumption, is that assets or money has disappeared. And a lot of it is with these third-party accounts receivables, which eventually ended up disappearing through other settles and other transactions. Something that I did allude to in 2009 as well.
So, Andrew, I mean, your thoughts on that? I mean, is accounting irregularities, it does seem to me that it would be fraud. Is it the same?
Yeah, I think it's a euphemism for it. I mean, and ultimately, I think the end result is the same, is that shareholders get cheated. You know, I mean, often in these larger and listed entities, management is rewarded on the basis of a combination of earnings, share price. All those things are supported by accounts that are manipulated. They get rewarded, shareholders get punished. I mean, it's a taking from some to give to others.
It's a non-virtuous circle.
Exactly. An interesting question for me is what's left in the stand of share price for shareholders. Is there anything there? I mean, this.
Do you think there is?
Well, I think on the positive side, and this may have been why the share price went up, is they state very clearly in this note that if they had need to write down the asset values or the balance sheet that they disclosed for the 31st of March 2017, that they would tell shareholders. It indicates to me a level of confidence on their part that they won't have further write-downs. So that's a positive. And the negative is that it's a very, very ugly balance sheet. You know, this has got to be the worst-looking balance sheet.
Since Petro S.A.
it's not a pretty sight. I mean, it's... Yeah, you ought to know something I don't, to bet on this company. In my view, I think this has been kept alive by creditors, by debt holders who kind of trying to maximise their position.
Which seems reasonable enough, I suppose, in the current circumstance. I was going to ask Andrew about that report, the Sean Holmes report. Right. After that came out, there was a lot of flack. You and I have spoken about it that JP Morgan got. From Steinhoff and from Marcus Yuster. Could you perhaps just elaborate on this and tell us what happened?
Yes. Okay. So Sean had written a report and he had done a lot of work and gone to a lot of trouble, and I mean, perhaps more trouble than usual, because we knew we had a thesis actually going into it, and as he went along, it seemed that thesis was proving correct. And you know, he had gone so far as to try get hold of financial statements of its foreign entities, find out who the auditors were. And he picked up a whole lot of anomalies. We published the report, and it was obviously negative. And Marcus then got hold of JP Morgan and wanted us to change the report, I guess. And he believed we didn't understand the company. And I had a series of meetings with him, and then later on one with Len Koner. The theme was the same. You know, Marcus would rattle on about the company, its history, and give
sales talk.
It was essentially a sales talk, yeah. And I don't remember much of it actually, because it was just a sales pitch, I think. Yeah. And we kept reiterating. If there's any factual error pointed out, we'll happily change it. If we're factually incorrect, and nothing was ever pointed out. I think, but through the whole process, there were certain things that really confirmed our concerns. I mean, I remember at one point Sean asking the FD at the time about certain how the margins got to be what they were in foreign entities versus local entities, what transfer pricing had made that possible. And at the time he replied, no, only Marcus deals with that, which is absurd.
Yeah, it's absolutely ridiculous.
It's absolutely absurd for a large listed entity.
Andrew, Sean is quite lucky to have you back him, because I'm not sure if a lot of analysts would have had the head of research say we're completely behind you, especially if you're being bullied by an executive like Marcus Yuster. Was there a backlash from JP Morgan itself? Because it also meant, as I understand it from reading Rob's book, that JP Morgan lost out a bit in terms of advisory work that then, you know, rolled on post 2007 in terms of all the business and the deals that Steinhoff did.
Yeah, so Yeah, I have two thoughts on that. I mean, thank you. But one is that, you know, if you're a football manager and you don't support your players, you know, you're going to not have a team pretty soon. You know, ask Jose Mourinho. So, you know, you back your players, and Sean was right, and I shared his thesis, so it wasn't hard.
Yeah.
You know, I absolutely believed in the thesis, and nothing, and all the evidence supported it, and you've got to go with the evidence before you, and that's what we did. The second issue on JP Morgan is there was absolutely no hint that them being against it or resisting it.
So you felt that you had the independence to go
sure.
out and say what you wanted.
And at one of the meetings, I had the country head at the time, John Zahner, go with me to see Marcus and Pete Ferreira. And John was absolutely supportive. So I never felt any issues.
Is that, I mean, now you have issues where I think it's a lot harder in the broking business, and research analysts have a much tougher time. We've seen a few examples like Tongaat where the analysts have come under certain pressure. Do you feel that the research analyst industry is a lot more under siege now, and that you find that dividing line between independent research not being quite as firm as it once was and potentially compromising the quality of the research?
Again, I don't know, Robert. I think there's a broader problem. I think there's a systemic problem where I think whistleblowers on sport. I mean, take Steinhoff. Let's go back to Steinhoff.
Yeah.
Here's a case where there's got to be a lot of people who knew that something was wrong. I don't necessarily think people were told not to say something, but I think just like in broking, there's a lot that's implicit.
Okay.
You know, if an analyst is aware that their bank is doing a lot of business with an entity, they would know that. You know, perhaps you know, nothing has to be said.
So sort of self censorship from the get go.
Correct. Yeah, I think there is. I mean, and I think in these entities, you know, Marcus was an absolutely dominant CEO.
I mean, we always talked about the cult of Marcus in his
correct,
book.
Correct, yeah. He wielded his authority. People feared him. But also, I think it suited people because people largely, as I understand it, were doing very well out of it. You know, so people were paid to be compliant,
yeah.
You know, up until it didn't.
But I do wonder why it is that so many analysts didn't, very few people saw this as something that was questionable. There was a strong sense that Steinhoff was on the up and up, and you should see it as a buy.
Yeah.
Why did so few people see through it?
I think a lot of people did see through it. I think there were a lot of asset managers who either were underweight, even at the time. I think there were a fair number of asset managers who were underweighted. I think there were people, certainly at the time Sean did his report, the market was quite divided. There were people who loved the stock and people who hated the stock. Mm. And so there were people. I mean, we met investors who wouldn't go near it even at that time. So I think it's what is it, the whole thing with Dick Cheney? Sort of, it was a known unknown, you know, rather.
But I must say, I remember those days where it was a lot more divided, and it was especially before they did the Conforama deal. But it was after that deal that I think a lot of people changed their minds on Steinhoff and thought, wow, this is a legitimate business. You know, it's the challenger to IKEA, you know, giant French-German company, and they've bought it at the right time after the financial crisis. They got a good deal. And it seemed to me, you know, having markets discussions every night, that there was a definite shift for people who thought, okay, maybe Steinhoff is actually
it's a real business.
It's real. It's genuine. It's not bogus. do you think because how else would Steinhoff have sucked in so much investor capital and become such a stalwart of the top 40 if not for a wider decision to back the Steinhoff horse?
Yeah, I mean, Rob and I have spoken about this before, and I wasn't so much Conforama for me. It was Christo Wiese.
The Pepco deal.
Yeah, and I at that time I thought two things. I mean, one is that one of my big issues with Steinhoff is that they just absorbed so much cash over so many years, consecutive years. You know, this was like a cash absorption machine, not a cash generation.
It's sort of like a mini Eskom.
Yeah, I mean, it was unbelievable how much cash they'd, and suddenly they had a business that was clearly cash generative, that was now part of the stable. So that we thought, well, actually, maybe this could look interesting. Then Chris had supposedly done his due diligence and he had gone in. And I think I mentioned to you at the time, my analogy was, you know, these are the mafia guys who'd kind of bought enough dry cleaners to suddenly be a dry cleaner business. You know,
nobody has to die here.
Yeah, exactly. And so it was very hard to resist at that point. They were so big. I guess, you know, if you're a long only manager, it was very, and you've got to say, you know, when I look at stuff, it's I never have 100% certainty. You know, there's always a decent probability that you're wrong.
Yeah.
And if you're a long-only investor managing other people's money, was it right to take the risks to not hold any Steinhoff? I mean, that's because given how large it was.
And you'd look bad because everyone else was doing well out of Steinhoff, and then by comparison,
it's a combination.
Poorly.
Yeah, perhaps you feel you are doing comparative analysis, but for me, it would be a risk thing. Is saying, well, if I'm wrong. You know, it's a huge benchmark risk to take. I mean, it's very aggressive not to hold any staff. I mean, well done to anyone who didn't.
Yeah. So you've been an analyst since 96. You were at JP Morgan, then Consilium. And, I mean, where does Steinhoff rate in terms of the big investment disasters in this country? What is the kind of the global context of Steinhoff? How should we think about it?
It's huge. I mean, it's up there with Theranos.
Theranos.
You know, yeah. I mean, it's of the same order. And lots of analogies as well. You know, the dominant CEO.
Theranos being the U.S. drugs company.
Yes, blood testing. You know, the cult of the CEO, etc. A lot of analogies. I don't know if anyone has to worry too much about these kind of frauds. I think they're so infrequent that, you know, you don't want to spend all your time looking for frauds. You know, and it's very seldom they happen with big companies. I think they're more likely to happen with smaller companies, which, for me, brings to another issue, which is the systemic problem, which is that CEOs now in many of these listed and sometimes large listed entities get to behave like owners. Is that you have a massive agency problem where, you know, directors are almost employed. To a large extent, by the CEO, they're identified by the executive members. They're on the board. They're co-opted, and they get to behave like owners. That can't be right.
How do you stop that from happening? I mean, what do you you know? If you had to talk about reforms, and I think was the Craig who talked about you know it's going to lead to more regulation, possibly the whole Steinhoff fallout. What would you suggest to stop the cult of the CEO from happening?
Well, as a start, I think you need truly independent directors. So, what is a truly independent director? So, truly independent director surely can't be someone that has the CEO and senior executive stamp of approval. You know, so there's no something that needs to be done about the appointment process. How does one identify directors that are truly independent? Perhaps there's a body that gets to appoint directors which are co-opted onto various boards.
Like a supervisory board.
Exactly.
Although Steinhoff has had a supervisory board.
Actually, was that example.
Bad example to use.
In terms of the other lessons from Steinhoff, in terms of this fraud, what would you say are the kind of things that boards could learn from identifying, when it comes to identifying frauds earlier than perhaps catching the next Steinhoff, which I'm sure is already out there?
It's very hard to say in the case of Steinhoff because I'm not sure what information the board had available to them. But some of it, just post the thing unraveling, I mean, some of the information that was coming out seems incredible. I mean, for instance, they appointed a company who was supposedly putting together a system so that they knew how much cash they had in different entities around the world. Bizarre. I mean, that should exist on a day-to-day basis for any well-managed company. Why was the board not aware of that? I mean, surely the question should have been asked about how you put information together, where does the information come from? And then even from the outside, I think there's certain signs that there are issues. I mean, it gets to a point where the balance sheet deteriorates to such a point that it's a problem. I mean, this should be evident to the board before it's evident to outsiders. And the other companies, I mean, I think Aspen's an example of this. I think Curragh's balance sheet is not pretty. I think it's a very ugly balance sheet as well. I mean, these are issues which are evident and should be even more obvious to the board with more information available.
Andrew, before we went on air, you were talking about a system to pass through accounts. I mean, is there a way for, and not just an analyst, but for a retail investor to apply a more rigorous to look at a set of company financials in a much more rigorous way and say, okay, I can come to my own conclusions about the health of this company?
Yes, I think not to the same extent as a professional investor, just because of the data available to professional investors and the time that is spent applying themselves. But you know, there's certain things that I think are easily gettable that provide signs. So, for instance, cash flow generation. It's not that a company needs to generate positive net cash flow every year, because sometimes they acquire stuff which is actually healthy for the long-term viability or growth of the company. But if a company consistently absorbs cash, it's a problem. You know, they're either going to have to raise capital or raise debt. And that, so you end up, quite simply, if you end up with a company that's not cash generative with huge levels of debt, you've got a problem. The other telltale signs, I mean, for instance, the ratio of non-operating assets to total assets. So by that I mean, and this is evident in the Steinhoff case, you know, the ratio of goodwill, trademarks, all these things which are generally
fluffy,
you know, you get when you acquire something and perhaps overpay. But that over time has proved a very good indicator of future underperformance. You know, once that ratio goes beyond a certain point. And that's also immediately evident on the balance sheet. I mean, companies that have a lot of goodwill, a lot of trademarks, a lot of potentially non-income producing assets.
Just lastly, what I was going to ask is, in terms of this, I mean, you were, JP Morgan was, and certainly Craig Butters was, one of the first few whistleblowers when it came to Steinhoff in terms of everything not being quite as kosher as Marcus used to would make it out to be. Do we change the financial system in a way that would pay greater heed towards what the skeptics, what the whistleblowers say about a company? I mean, how would you do that? Is that even possible?
I don't know. You run the risk of kind of predicting what... Ten of the last declines or something.
Yeah,
you know, that didn't happen. I really don't know. I don't think it has to happen from an outside analyst point of view. I think we got good information. I think we got enough information to make decisions which may be right or might be wrong. But I think we get enough information. We get all the information that I think we can have as outsiders generally. I mean, this management can lie to us and does, I think, on occasion. I think the real issue is internally, what companies are doing, how boards are appointed, diversity within boards. I mean, if you look at that board of Steinhoff, I mean, it wasn't a very diverse board. Mm. You know, a lot of old white guys.
Old white chartered accountants.
Yeah. And there's other boards like that in South Africa. So I think improving diversity of the boards, definitely finding a mechanism to appoint truly independent directors would be helpful. From an accounting point of view, there's lots of scope for companies to choose a more or less aggressive accounting policies, and that's always going to be the case.
Yeah. A couple of executives I've spoken to whose share prices have been under pressure sort of lament the post-Steinhoff world and say it's as if investors don't believe anything we say, and they're looking for the next Steinhoff, they're looking for the next big lie, which does sound a sort of a bit of a lament on the executive's part if their share prices are under pressure. But do you think there is a justified worry there that nothing will ever be the same post Steinhoff, that people swing to the I suppose the other side of the pendulum, that they take nothing for granted. They look at a set of accounts and think, I'm not sure if I can believe any of this. Do you think that's a danger, or just actually makes us all sharpen our wits a little bit more when it comes to going through a company's financials?
No, I think it's all cyclical. I think in a few years we'll all forget about this thing. At some point we'll have a bull market and we'll all get gung-ho about it again.
Building up the next time.
Yeah, and we'll build it and then something will hit us. And I think it's a function also of where the South African market is. I mean, people are probably more pessimistic than they have been for
mostly
a long time.
In the dark, thanks to Eskom.
Yes. Yeah. People can't read financial statements at this point.
And on that note, maybe before our power gets switched off, Andrew, thanks very much for joining us in the studio today.
Pleasure.